someone's dropped a bomb somewhere, contaminating atmosphere and blackening the sky. It's Good News Wheat.
I'm Sherwood Martinelli. I'm the publisher of the Green Nuclear Butterfly and a member of the board of Fuse USA.
We're just outside of Peekskill. And how far from Indian Point?
We're less than 3 miles straight as the crow flies. Later on today, I'll take you for a drive down to Washington and Welcher Avenue, and the first thing you'll see is the twin domes of the two working nuclear reactors.
Right.
So I am in the circle of death.
Explain your background, where you come from.
I grew up in rural America. As a child, I grew up outside of Jeffersonville, Indiana, which at the time I lived there was a small rural farming community. I grew up baling hay, picking corn, working out in the field. I grew up, if you will, with an appreciation of Mother Nature and Mother Earth, and grew up basically believing that you leave the world a better place for those who follow in your footsteps. And so I've always had a love of Earth and a desire to do what I could to protect it and leave it better than when I found it.
You've worked very much with the Earth and farming communities.
Well, yeah, and even when I grew up, I was a potter and sculptor for 20 years, and my studio was located on 40 acres out in the woods of southeastern Ohio. So again, even as an artist and in my life-chosen profession, if you will, I was still working with the Earth. I was still keeping my hands dirty.
That's right. Your hand was touching the Earth.
Yeah.
So, and so what brings you to being very much involved with the Indian Point, taking up this side of the campaign?
Okay, let's back up a few years.
Yeah.
I became, if you will, a rabid environmentalist starting back in the early 90s. As I said, I lived on 40 acres out in the woods of southeastern Ohio. And Ohio Power, which is owned by American Electrical Power, came to me and said, we want to put a 40-foot wide by almost 1,000-foot long bowling alley through your woods to replace one utility pole on my neighbor's property, because they'd allowed their easement to get into disrepair to where they could no longer access that pole via the neighbor's property. Well, if you need to go through my woods, we can make arrangements for that, but you're not cutting my trees. And they said, yes, we can. I said, no, you can't. They said, yes, we can. I said, no, you can't. And they then went into court and got a temporary restraining order that was going to allow them to blitzkrieg through my property and put a 40-foot bowling alley through my woods. And a sheriff came up at about 6 o'clock at night and served me with this temporary restraining order that was going to allow them to do it. And being German, Dutch, and Irish, that kind of pissed me off.
Fair enough.
So yeah. I made a few phone calls and stayed up all night and used the paperwork that they gave me to write my own legal motions. And then I drove one of my pickup trucks down over to a bridge, because I lived on a one-lane dirt road across the railroad tie bridge, and I drove my one pickup truck across the bridge. Then I hiked back up to the house and took my second pickup truck and drove it halfway down the road and parked it and put the hood up and put a sign on it, gone into town to get part to fix my truck, and drove to the courthouse because I knew that they were going to be coming up to blitzkrieg through my property. And what I did was I asked the judge to grant me a temporary restraining order of my own that precluded clear cutting on so much as 1 square foot of my property. And the judge granted it, which then ensued a 3.5-year legal battle, which I won. They never got to cut the trees on my property. And to this day, I have the narrowest utility easement ever written in the United States on that piece of property down in southeastern Ohio. And while I was in that fight, I started learning a tremendous amount about utility easement clearing. In other words, utilities come through, and to maintain their easements, they literally cut down tons and tons of trees. And a major contributing factor to global warming is loss of canopy cover.
Exactly, yeah.
And so to put this in perspective, and this just in the United States, what I found out was the utility industry in the United States, A, has the equipment to eliminate 90% of the utility easement clearing that they do. They won't put that equipment up for one simple reason. in America, if you upgrade your equipment, that comes out of the utility company's bottom line corporate profits. Utility easement clearing, cutting down all those trees, is a maintenance issue, and the utility industry is allowed to pass all maintenance costs clear through to the inline consumer of their product. So they'd rather continue spending millions and millions and millions and millions of dollars a year cutting down trees than to upgrade their equipment, because it's a pass-through cost. And let's put that utility easement clearing in perspective. The utility company back in 1991, 1992, I read a report, and I guess I should explain how I got the report, because the utility industry is very secretive. They won't let you know a lot of stuff, and you can't even get some of their catalogs. So I got to thinking about that and said, there must be some way I can get these reports. So I formed my own one-person electric co-op. And then, because I was a utility, they gave me the documents. Okay? So anyway, what I found out was the utility industry every year in America cuts down 96,000 trees for utility easement clearing. But let's put that in further perspective. The utility industry only considers a tree when it has a diameter 4 foot above the ground of at least 6 inches in diameter. Mm-hmm. Anything under that, a maple that's 20 foot tall, that's scrub. They don't inventory it. Mm. So really, they're probably cutting down more than half a million trees a year. Well, when you realize the canopy cover loss that represents, and then you start carrying that through Canada, Mexico, Australia, England, it's monumental. So in other words, if you want to stop global warming, there's one crucial key ingredient to the fix. We need to restore canopy cover. And a real quick way to restore some of the canopy cover is to stop utility easement clearing. So while I was involved in this fight, I instantly was given a label because they did an article on my fight in USA Today newspaper, and the USA Today newspaper called me an environmental gadfly. And I guess it's kind of stuck over the years.
Tell me how can one old man decide for me and you that it's necessary to stow away the truth and still call it democracy? Tell me why does any one of us just look away when lies and broken promises betray?
Tonight I have a message for the people of the world. America's purpose is to incite fear, terror, and to mass murder. We are building a culture to encourage international terrorism, to achieve the end of the civilized world. Go home and die.
What do we trust? What do we believe? What do we support? What do we fight for? What do we die for, Mr. President?
How do you sleep at night?
While I was involved in that issue, there was an industrial park that they were wanting to enlarge, and they were going to increase the length of the airport to start bringing in cargo planes, because there was a Colgate plant there, and they were wanting to bring in cargo planes and fly the inventory out to the West Coast, wherever. I opposed it because those airplanes would then be flying right over my solitude in the woods. So I was against it. So I started investigating documents, environmental documents, degradation of water, so forth and so on. And while I was studying those documents, I came across this document. It was like, no, this can't be true. Unfortunately, it was true. And what I did was I uncovered a specialty steel alloy company in Bysville, Ohio called Shield Alloy. And them and their predecessors, including the Foot Mineral Company, had dumped over 600,000 tons of low-level radioactive waste into a wetlands that drained into my community's only drinking water supply, which was Wills Creek. Mm-hmm. But in addition to that, They'd also been giving the stuff away as road and construction fill for almost 40 years, so that over 200 of the 1,200 homes in our county had radioactively contaminated foundations.
Mm.
So that's when I formed the Save the Wills Creek Water Resources Committee and basically got the NRC, which is the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, to believe that I was a huge environment organization, which I wasn't. And just a little by-note about the NRC and why I don't trust the NRC. In my investigations of this particular site, I found out that the NRC had lost this licensee's file and had forgot to police it for 23 years. We just forgot to police it. So when it was all said and done and over, because I won't bore you or your listeners with the long story.
That's all right. This is all right.
When I was finished, I talked class action attorneys into flying in from California and interviewing some people. And once they were satisfied that everything I was telling them was absolute God's truth, they instituted a class action lawsuit against the responsible corporate parties that had done this, and we were successful in getting all 200 homes remediated. And in some cases, that remediation included bulldozing down the houses, removing the radioactive contamination, and building new houses. So, I mean, we're talking fairly significant, way, way, way above background radiation here.
Yeah.
And we were successful in getting the NRC to order a $70 million cleanup of the site. I didn't get what I wanted because I wanted the materials completely removed and taken elsewhere. Instead, they rechanneled the creek to change the directional stream run of the water and then encapsulated it on site for the next 1.4 million years. But it was a victory nonetheless.
Wow.
While all that was going on, the DOE back in the early 80s, I found out, because once you get involved in this stuff, if you're a caring person that has a certain sympathy and empathy with your fellow co-inhabitants of this world we live in, you realize that this is a serious issue. And I lived basically about 2.5 hours drive from the gaseous diffusion plant in Portsmouth. And for starters, a great deal of the depleted uranium that is now killing people on the tips of armor-piercing ballistics comes from Portsmouth.
Right.
We're talking literally tens of thousands of rusting barrels of it, just stacked like 6 and 8 tall for miles. I've driven along the fence line, and it's just absolutely heartbreaking. So I then started getting involved in issues with both low-level radioactive waste and high-level radioactive waste. And in the early 80s, the DOE came up with this scheme. And basically, they had a law passed through Congress where each state was responsible to dispose of their own low-level radioactive waste. But then they encouraged the states to band together into compacts and build low-level radioactive waste sites. And at that point in time, the Midwest Compact, which was Ohio, Indiana, Wisconsin, Michigan, and I think there was one other state, I think there was 5 states were going to cite a compact. And conveniently, Ohio had been chosen as the place they were going to build this wondrous man-built disaster zone. And so I opposed it and was going to all the compact meetings and listening to their litany of lies. And started on my own filing FOIA after FOIA and requesting document after document, using the internet looking for more documents. And I finally found a Senate subcommittee piece of testimony that had been delivered. And what I found out was what the DOE really planned on doing was getting one or two of these facilities sited and built. And then they were going to pass a law making them the nation's repository for all low-level radioactive waste. I broke that document to the Columbus Dispatch, and 4 days later, the Midwest Compact was disbanded. The low-level radioactive waste site was never built. So,
right work.
Yeah. Then in the meantime, the Bush family is more than intimately, they're incestuously involved
yeah,
in the quote-unquote nuclear renaissance in GNEP, which is the Global Nuclear Energy Program. A lot of people don't know this, but I've already briefly talked about the gaseous diffusion plants. If you go back to the 1992 Energy Policy Act, buried way deep into the bowels of this document, is one little paragraph. And that one little paragraph took Portsmouth and Piketon's gaseous diffusion plants, which are the largest environmental superfunds ever created in the entire world, and privatized them. And created the United States Enrichment Corporation, which is now known as USEC.
Explain what USEC is.
USEC basically is the company that produces and sells most of the fuel rods that power nuclear reactors.
Right, that's right.
And also, a lot of people like to try to separate the military from the commercial side of nuclear power. There is no separation.
Right.
Because you can't have depleted uranium to put on the tips of armor-piercing ammunition without depleted uranium. You can't have depleted uranium without the commercial fuel cycle. So they're literally twin sides of a Rosemary's Baby set of Siamese twins. They both need to be shut down.
Yeah.
President Bush signed this into law for two reasons. One, they wanted to privatize the process by which uranium fuel was produced, because the big money players of the world saw that as another line of profit for corporate America, the world corporate whatever, and so they privatized it. But then the other reason they privatized it was because the cleanup criteria for private nuclear industrial sites is much more lax and therefore much less expensive than the criteria for cleanup of DOD and DOE sites. So in other words, they privatized it so that they could provide the citizens of America a far less adequate cleanup of the damage that they had done.
It was terribly expensive and virtually impossible.
The other thing that they did, the third reason why they privatized it, is that then allowed them to transfer jurisdictional oversight from the DOE to the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. And a lot of people don't realize this, but what the NRC really stands for is no regulatory control.
Ah, really?
Well, yeah, because what you run into is you have EMRI, which is the research arm of the energy industry. And then you have NEI, which is the Nuclear Energy Institute. You have the NRC, which is no regulatory control, which is actually the bastard stepchild of the DOE. And here's the problem you run into, and I'll just give you one example. Let's look at nuclear reactor security. The industry wants to spend as little money as possible, because the more money they spend on making sure that we're actually safe and secure from a terrorist threat is detracting from their bottom line corporate profits, because that's all that drives them is profit. Now, you would think our government would be more concerned about public health and safety, which is supposedly their edict. When they were created by Congress, their edict is to protect human health and public safety, but they don't really do that. And by that, what I mean is, like right now, for instance, EMRI is doing research work to justify the NEI's petitions to have a laxed set of security standards for nuclear power reactors. And the NEI then takes those guidelines that were created with EMRI's investigative work and submits them to the NRC. And the NRC then embraces and adopts them and codifies them into the regulations. So in effect, de facto, you have the utility industry, the energy industry, and the nuclear industry self-policing themselves. Well, how can you have somebody self-policing themselves when their first concern isn't public health and safety, but corporate bottom line profits? It's a recipe for disaster.
Absolutely.
And that's what we have.
Yeah.
So when I found out what was going on, obviously you're not going to be able to stop something like that. A whole bunch of people in closed, dark, smoky rooms made the decision that those two plants were going to be privatized, but I was at least able to delay the relicensing for about a year and a half longer than they expected, which at least that gives me a satisfaction knowing I cost them millions, if not billions of dollars, because I jumped up and down and screamed and yelled, which I'm really good at, and got the Department of Energy to overnight express me the entire 54,000 page EIS for the gaseous diffusion plant in Portsmouth, Ohio. And then I went without sleep for about a week, and I submitted 117 pages of comments and questions challenging the environmental issues at the site. So by the time they read my document and verified all my sites and addressed some of my issues, we held up the license and we at least got them to address a few of the environmental concerns at the site. And by then I was tired. I needed to take a break. So I sold my pottery company, took a year, went to Europe, came back, flew out to the West Coast, hiked up into Arches National Park, spent some time on the Colorado River, and then decided I should go to college. I thought, like, in my 40s it was time to go to school. So that's what I did. I went to school, and I was actually attending the honors program up at SUNY Plattsburgh. And I met my wife on the internet. I always like to joke and say it was love at first bite. And and so I started driving every weekend 5.5 hours one way to spend time with a lady. You know, love makes us do crazy things like that. And when you're in love, you really don't take the time to pay attention to certain little details, like the fact that she lived 2.5 miles from a nuclear reactor. And so we met, we fell in love, we met online in like March. I met her for the first time face to face in like April, and that September we were married, which was 7 years ago. It was only after I moved down here and basically transferred my life here to Peekskill that I all of a sudden basically went part of my French, holy fuck, we live less than 3 miles from the nuclear reactor. And so then I started investigating this nuclear reactor. And one, the first thing I found was just the most atrocious safety record you wanted to see. And then I started finding out things like the NRC loves to mitigate. Like one of the buzz phrases you'll hear from the nuclear industry is no immediate danger. Well, that's a book everybody should read, because what no immediate danger is, you have a question.
Who wrote the book?
I don't know.
Okay. No, I mean, we can Google it.
I can tell you she lives up in Canada. I can tell you she's elderly. I can tell you she's a very bright lady. She, in a lot of ways, the woman that wrote the book, preceded to Caldecott. If that puts it into perspective for you.
Yeah.
People need to understand what no immediate danger is. You're standing here with your little digital tape recorder listening to me, and if I all of a sudden, for no reason, jump up and punch you in the nose, that's immediate danger.
So when
they tell you that you are under no immediate danger from a nuclear reactor being in your backyard, that's what they mean. That nuclear reactor is not going to jump up off of its foundation and punch you in the nose.
Yeah.
However, their radioactive effluence into the air, their dumping of tritium and strontium and God knows what other contaminants into the Hudson River on a daily basis will cause long-term damage. There's the Tooth Fairy Project that has proven conclusively that there's elevated levels of strontium-90 in babies' teeth in and around nuclear facilities. But then what the nuclear industry wants to do, because they don't like to take any legal responsibility for their actions, they'll claim, oh, well, that must have come from bomb testing, or that came from the Chernobyl accident. It's never their fault. Despite the fact that we know that Indian Point right now has strontium-90 leaks on the site, they have tritium leaks on the site, but then what the NRC says, well, yes, there are leaks, and yes, we don't know where those leaks are, and because we don't know where those leaks are, we really can't say with any certainty how much of the materials are actually leaking out into the environment, but we know that the licensee is within its release criteria. Well, that's kind of a bogus cop-out, because for starters, if you know anything about leaks, if you don't fix them, they get bigger.
Right.
Over time, it's common sense, okay?
Yeah.
If you have water leaking into the foundation of your house and you don't address and repair that house, that wall is going to weaken and weaken and weaken, and eventually it's going to collapse. It's common sense. But the problem is, they don't care about common sense. They don't use common sense because they're driven by one thing, profits. Whatever it takes for the corporate bottom line. And unfortunately, what it takes for the corporate bottom line is they lie to the citizens. So that's how I got involved in now fighting and taking on the regulatory industry and trying to close Indian Point. But I'm not just satisfied with closing Indian Point, because now that I've started doing my research and I've literally read tens of thousands of pages I've downloaded from the internet on this, you keep back and forth like a yo-yo. Well, for starters, we have George Bush Sr. privatized the gaseous diffusion plants. In 1996, when then-Governor George Bush was governor of Texas and was starting to entertain thoughts of running for president, he needed money. And he needed lots of money. So Daddy Bush said, embrace the nuclear industry. Embrace the nuclear industry, tell them you'll do whatever it takes to get them wherever they need to go, and they will give you the money you need. And that's what happened. He sold out to the nuclear industry back in 1996, and basically the day he was elected, he was the nuclear president, which is why he's the one pushing the Nuclear 2010 program. He's the one that's pushing the GNET program. He's the one that's pushing Congress to ever increase by billions of dollars the budget for the nuclear industry and for the Department of Energy. And the problem with that is back in 1998, the DOE decided for security reasons, so again, you can't separate the military side from the commercial side, for the U.S. to remain a superpower, for them to be the number one nuclear kingpin of the world and have better weapons and stronger weapons and bigger bombs, that they needed to revitalize the nuclear industry. So they formed NERAC.
What's NERAC?
It was basically a committee that was supposed to get together and think, because that's what these guys do, is they think. And see, this is the problem with a lot of science and a lot of these committees. They're given a goal to attain, and so they only study and only research what's going to prove or support what they've been created to do. And in this case, NERAC was created to figure out a way to bring forth a nuclear renaissance, because they decided it was in the United States' strategic best interest to have a renaissance of the nuclear industry, to save it from just dying a slow death. Personally, I'd like to see it die a faster death, but that's okay, you know. And so one of the first things this committee reported out of committee was that to have a nuclear renaissance, to actually be able to build a second new generation of nuclear reactors, the NRC would need to relicense every aging nuclear reactor in America, whether it was safe or not, because if the nuclear industry could not maintain its market share during the changeover to this new generation of reactors, Wall Street wouldn't touch them. So in other words, we've got the NRC relicensing 104 aging reactors with seriously known issues. Not because it's in the best interest of public health and safety, but because it's the only way they can pave the road to a nuclear future. Well, common sense again tells you that you do not build the road to the future on antiquated science and technology. And yet that's exactly what we're doing. So in effect, we have the NRC de facto playing Russian roulette with 67 communities here in America and other communities worldwide, because with arm twisting, they're getting people like the Prime Minister of Australia to embrace George Bush's drive for a nuclear renaissance. Well, with all due respect to George Bush, if you look at his war strategy for Iraq, he's not exactly the man whose policies that I would want to be following. He's made mistake after mistake after mistake after mistake. Well, again, common sense would tell you that if somebody has had almost 7 years in office, and in that entire 7 years he's done nothing right? Why would you believe him when he says nuclear energy is the road to tomorrow? So that's part of the puzzle. But then the second part of the puzzle, which is really frightening because it shows just how devious and incestuous corporate America and our government have become. Another thing they passed out of this committee was the fact that they needed to change public perception of nuclear energy. And they had a very devious way to do it. They were going to steal the green movement. And people go, no, there's no way. Come on, we carry our hemp-woven bags to the grocery store and put our groceries in it, and we drink healthy products, and we eat healthy food, and we wear green-friendly clothing, and how could they corrupt our minds? Real simple. They were going to steal the green movement by changing our slogan from no nukes to no CO2s. And present nuclear is the safe, vital, secure, green savior from global warming. And they almost had it right, but they needed one more hook. The hook? Even though the technology isn't available, even though it's still fuzzy science and they haven't proven it, they've promised us that the next generation of nuclear reactors are going to give birth to the hydrogen economy and bring everybody electric cars.
Oh, yeah, really?
And this is the propaganda that they've been feeding to the general public like pablum, and they're sucking it up. And they're sucking it up because the nuclear industry whined and dined and wooed the press first so that they would carry their message to the masses. Which brings us to where we are today, where you have literally, right now, it doesn't take a rocket scientist to look at the fact that the NRC, for instance, right now, has looked and made a final decision on 48 nuclear reactors. The mathematical odds of them relicensing 48 and denying relicense to none, it can't be. We all know that there's no way you're going to tell me that when you have 48 aged, decaying nuclear reactors with coolant leaks, with tritium leaks, with strontium leaks, with failing spent fuel pools, with fuel pools that are packed to capacity, and I could go on and on and on infinitum, but in other words, it's mathematically impossible, if they were really adequately reviewing and looking at the risk, for them to say, oh yeah, 48 of these all get relicensed, none of them have anything significantly enough wrong with them to deny them a relicense. So the fix is in. The NRC is literally rubber stamping these relicense applications.
Right.
So, and that's how you came to be sitting in my house today with your little machine tape recording me.
Right, I meant to meet you. You just did these diagrams here in relation to water, because this is the key to life, water. You explained it very well, through this diagram of what a reactor. Could you go over this whole...
Okay, I'm not a scientist, but I play one on TV.
Right.
Okay. Again, because I'm a farm boy, there's a certain connection to everything. Without water, plants won't grow. If the plants won't grow, we can't feed people, so forth and so on. And there's even studies out now by the government where the two key crucial elements of the future right now are supplying and meeting our energy demands.
Right.
And water.
Right.
You know,
exactly.
Those are the one-two punch.
We're made of water. We come from water.
Right. So. And there's a very, very serious, real concern that we're going to have inadequate fresh water supplies to meet the human needs. And, of course, because conservation of scarce natural resources runs totally contrary to a consumer-driven society that creates corporate profits, and that's part of your problem. In other words, at some point in time, we're going to have to wake up and realize, like Arlo Guthrie says, we don't need all this stuff. We have too much stuff, okay? Why do we need to live in 8, 10, 12-room homes? Why do we need 12-foot ceilings? We need to get back to where we live in smaller houses and have bigger yards with gardens.
Exactly.
And we grow our own vegetables, and we grow our own flowers, and reclaim that sense of community. Let's tear down the privacy fences between all the yards and open it up into one big city block park for everybody that lives on the block, with one swimming pool for the entire block, rather than, like, the block I live in. We have 12 houses. There's 7 swimming pools. It's like, hello, why do we need 7 swimming pools? And why are we heating 7 swimming pools? And why are we filtering the water for 7 swimming pools? Whereas if we were to eliminate all those privacy fences, we could have one swimming pool for all 12 families, which then would give us a lot more room to have a big community vegetable garden, so forth and so on. But I'm getting off track here a little bit. But I only share this because one of the largest consumers of water in the world are nuclear reactors. And even though I'm not a scientist, I have a certain amount of common sense. I have some theories on that. One, let's use Indian Point as an example. That nuclear reactor, 7 days a week, 365 days a year, each and every day, is sucking into the intake valves 2.5 billion gallons of water, and then spewing it out the discharge canal at an elevated temperature of between 103 and 105 degrees.
All right.
Think about that. We right now have 443 nuclear reactors in the world, all doing the same thing. So now you're talking about putting trillions of gallons of hot water into the world's waterways, raising the temperature. Indian Point, for instance, will claim that 3 miles down the river from Indian Point, they're only raising the ambient temperature of the water 1 degree. Well, okay, let's see here. Didn't I read somewhere that global warming is happening because we're raising the ambient temperature of the world 1 or 2 degrees? There should be a ding-dong bell ringing somewhere here. Nuclear reactors elevating the ambient temperature of the water 1 degree. The average temperature of the world increases by 1 degree. And we have melting of the polar ice caps. It's like there's got to be a connection there. But let's set that aside for a minute, okay? I was reading a National Geographic article about 3 months ago, and they state that we've depleted 90% of the world's fish resources. Think about it. 90% of the food from the ocean is gone.
Right.
And they want to blame overfishing and 40 million other things, but they don't want to blame nuclear reactors. Okay, well now, let's think about that. Indian Point kills millions of little baby fishies every year with their discharges. Times 443 nuclear reactors around the world. Now means you've got hundreds of millions of fish that never lived.
Right.
They never reproduced. They never had babies. In other words, we're not overfishing the bounty of Mother Earth. We're killing its ability to perpetuate itself.
Yeah, right.
Okay? So now all of a sudden, it's like when you start looking at the bigger picture of nuclear energy, you got to start taking a step back and look at the whole big picture. It's like, oh, well, wait a minute. All that hot water being dumped back into the river and dumped back into the ocean is killing fish.
And by killing the fish, killing their ability to reproduce and create more fish. Because seriously, you're talking a half a billion lost fish each year times 40 years. Again, you're talking trillions of lost fish all over the world, not counting how many babies would they have. So it's like, let's look at what's really causing the depletion of the fish population in our oceans and in our rivers and in our lakes. Is it global warming and overfishing? Or is it our love and embracing of nuclear energy that's doing that? So you've got that going on. Then you sit here and you go back to all this hot water going into the rivers. Well, if I were to build a snowman, for instance, and leave it sit outside, that snowman will last a fairly long time. But if I take that snowman and I turn on a hose, not even with hot water, but if I just start running water underneath the base of that snowman, it will weaken from the base up and collapse.
All right.
Well, now, if we're elevating the temperature of the world's water, and that water runs underneath the global ice caps, what's it going to do?
Yeah, it's just common sense.
It's common sense.
Going to happen.
Right. Okay, then another interesting thing, and there's studies that are starting to come out on this, is the ice caps and the glacier situation really started melting in earnest a couple years after Chernobyl.
Uh-huh.
Well, I personally don't think it's an accident that as they're studying these glaciers and looking at the thermal cover and everything, they're finding vast amounts of Celsium-137. Celsium-137 is a byproduct of nuclear reactors. And when Chernobyl exploded, it dumped literally millions and millions and millions and millions of particulates of Celsium-137 into the sky, and then that was carried by the wind all over the world, including onto the polar ice caps. Because one of the things that frustrates me about the nuclear industry and the NRC is I'm opposing relicensing of Indian Point. I have to prove I'm a stakeholder. And they have this huge, long criteria of who is and isn't a stakeholder. And basically, here in America, you have to live within a 5, 10, or 25-mile radius of a nuclear plant for them to give you standing as a stakeholder or be part of the nuclear industry. They're all stakeholders, aren't they? Well, the folly of that line of thinking is if there is, or when there is, a significant nuclear incident and or a terrorist attack on a nuclear reactor here in America, the contaminants from that incident are not going to stay in a 25-mile circle. They're going to travel all around the world. So, in effect, every citizen of the world should be granted stakeholder status on every issue concerning anything to do with nuclear. And I'm talking from the beginning process, when they begin mining the uranium out of the ground, because the processing and purification of uranium is one of the most intensive industrial processes in the entire world. They throw millions and millions of tons of CO2 up into our atmosphere just in the processing of the uranium, and yet then they want to march out and lie to the public and say, we're a CO2-free, clean, green, vital, safe, secure energy. It's horseshit. Because the problem is, maybe the middle of the sandwich, the production of the nuclear energy is CO2 free, but they got the dirtiest bread on both sides of the sandwich you ever wanted to see.
You know, Australia is upping it at the moment. Both the Liberal and the Labor Party are going to increase the production of and the mining of uranium. We need to bring that...
Well, but see, here's the problem, too, and I'm glad you brought that up, is the more uranium we mine, the less rich are the deposits.
Yeah.
Which then means that it's going to require much more intensive mining and much more intensive processing to get the same amount of materials. And then the nuclear industry loves to trot out hocus-pocus, mad science stuff about, oh, we got enough nuclear uranium in the world to supply the world with energy for the next 10,427 years or whatever their figure is. Russia has just built a floating nuclear reactor. They can float it anywhere in the world and provide you with electricity. I don't think that's what it's really for. When the nuclear industry tells you there's all this uranium, part of the inventory they're counting is the uranium that's suspended in the ocean. And what their grand scheme is, they're going to build these huge floating mining operations.
Really?
Powered by nuclear reactors that will then float around the world's oceans, sucking the ocean water up into this floating industrial complex and suck all the uranium out of it. There's another line of thinking that says one of the reasons why we have a place to live is the uranium suspended in the ocean keeps it from freezing.
Okay.
If we suck all the uranium out of the world's oceans,
yeah,
we will solve global warming. And we will become Mars. A frozen, desolate wasteland where nothing can live because the ambient temperature will maybe be 200 degrees below zero.
Wow.
Boxes on the hillside, little boxes made of ticky-tacky, little boxes, little boxes, little boxes, all the same.
I remember Dr. David Suzuki said that stuck in my mind in a radio program on the ABC in Australia was that if you're a scientist, you think like a scientist. And they can't think anywhere else. Doctor, that's their mind works right. In that way. Certain people that have this speciality, it's very hard for them to really connect the dots.
I don't know if you have this expression in Australia.
Yeah.
Scientists, accountants, whatever, they're incapable of thinking outside of the box.
That's right. Yeah. That's okay. Right. It's thinking outside the box.
Right. Yeah. And that's the problem is they live in these little boxes. We become a specially oriented society.
Yes, specialized.
Okay, everything's been cubicled and compartmentalized and boxed and packaged and homogenized to where these people, they only know about what they do.
Yeah. See, they're not evil people. It's just they're totally caught up with their trip.
I like to say they're limited in vision.
Right.
If you could only broaden their scope. The problem is most of the world's professionals today, they have tunnel vision. They literally can only see what's right in front of their eyes.
Yeah.
They no longer have their peripheral vision.
Right.
And because they lack that peripheral vision, they're incapable of seeing the whole truth. And unless you can see the whole truth, unless you can look at the big picture,
right. You're
literally helping pave a way and a road to hell.
Yeah. Well, this is where we're at now, and this is the bells are ringing really loud because it's out there that we've got like 10 years to solve this whole thing. At the moment, the bells are ringing all over the world that we've got to solve climate change.
Look.
Yeah.
You can't solve global warming by looking at the people and promising them a placebo that doesn't even exist. In other words, we've got the utility industry and we've got corporate America and we have the world's financial industries all saying that we're going to solve this in such a fashion that you're not going to have to change the way you live. You're going to be able to continue to blindly consume
mm-hmm.
materials mm. and resources. Mm. And don't even worry about it. Just keep spending your money.
Mm.
Okay? No, we need a serious, as I like to say,
paradigm shift.
But seriously, we need a serious paradigm shift to where we live and tread lightly upon the earth. We consume fewer things. We live in smaller houses. We get our hands back into the earth. We learn how to get dirty again.
Right.
We don't own a 2,800 or 3,600 or 5,100 square foot home and house four people in it, and we don't have a three-car garage, and we don't have three or four cars in the driveway. This is all common sense.
And you get fit by moving around.
We went to town once or twice a month.
Mm-hmm.
Not every day. We didn't run down to the 7-Eleven to get a Slurpee Big Gulp. You made a shopping list, and you drove to town once or twice a month, and usually you took two or three neighbors with you because they had a shopping list, and everybody would go into town, and it was a fun event. You had that sense of community.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, I'm not a particular fan of Hillary Clinton, but it's like she says, it takes a village to raise a child.
Right.
There's a certain truism in that. Well, we need to get back to that sense of community, that sense of village, because that's what we really are. We're one big global village. And we've lost sight of that reality. Because I guarantee you, what we do here in America will affect and contaminate and kill villages all around the world. And what they do in England and what they're doing in China as they race into the industrial age. China's becoming the largest pollutant in the world. And so the reality of it is, these are the things we need to shift. People mm-hmm. don't want to hear the discussion. The churches definitely don't want to hear the discussion. But when are we going to address the fact that Mother Earth can only sustain so many human bodies?
Yeah.
You can't have birth rates of 3 and 4 and 5 kids because we need to rein in our population. And I know that's a touchy subject, but the fact of the matter is, we do it with deer herds. We manage every other living creature population in the world, but we're so stupid that we don't realize we need to manage our own population growth. Because we've gone from 1 million people to 2 million people,
yeah.
to 100 million people to 200 million yeah. people, to 500 million people to 1 billion people.
And you know what's going on in our country, in Australia? They encourage people to have babies. They just want more and more. They get so emotional about women who want to have abortions and so forth. They're encouraging the population growth. It's quite the opposite.
Yeah, and then all of a sudden, it's like, Australia is Australia. And I've never been on a walkabout. I'd love to go on one. But coming from rural America, okay, but no, one of the beauties of Australia is its vast, untapped wilderness areas. That's what makes Australia, Australia. You know, everybody yeah. says everything's big in Texas. No, everything's big in Australia. And the problem is, the world is shrinking. And the world's shrinking not because the world's getting smaller, but because we're overpopulating it. And if Australia doesn't
exactly.
wake up and see that reality,
you got
okay,
yeah.
I live in a small town.
Yeah.
Well, it's kind of scary to think that I live in a small town. And a small town is considered 25,000 people. Where I come from, like when I had my pottery in southeastern Ohio, the closest town to where I lived had a population of 123 people.
Right.
That's a small town.
Yeah.
Okay, but here, you're sitting here, think about it. Within a 50-mile radius of New York City and Indian Point Nuclear Reactor, we have 21 million people.
Yeah, and that's another crazy thing about Indian Point, allowing to just keep on going.
Oh, yeah.
When you've got this...
Well, but that's part of the problem, is the NRC and the nuclear industry's theory and ruse, if you will, because they're basically playing Russian roulette with our lives, is we believe that we can manage the aging effects of that plant in such a fashion is to keep it up and running for 20 years. The fact that they've got serious significant embrittlement issues and fatigue issues, and in fact the NRC even admits when it comes to understanding reactor containment and core aging and embrittlement issues, that they have a lack of information. In other words, it's a hypothesis. They're taking a guess. Well, you don't take a guess at keeping a nuclear reactor open for another 20 years when, if their hypothesis is wrong, you're playing with the safety and security and lives of 21 million people. Look at Chernobyl. Look at the fallout area. Look at the dead zone where nobody can live. And then take that same dead zone and lay it over a map of Indian Point, with Indian Point at the center of that dead zone. New York is gone. It doesn't exist anymore.
Absolutely.
Okay.
It's gone.
It's gone. White Plains is gone. You go north, you're looking at the fact that depending on how significant the incident would be, not only is New York City gone, but Albany, New York State's capital, would be gone.
Right.
It's madness. And yet that's what they're trying to perpetuate on us, all in the name of a nuclear renaissance. Again, we come full circle.
Right.
Oh, say, can you see innocent people as they flee from our huge Air Force jets that we fly across the sea, and our proud cluster bombs that destroy life and limb for generations to come from the ground that they causes. Well, we really just don't care. Oh, say, does that star-spangled banner yet wave o'er the land of corporate greed and the home of its slaves?
Fantastic. It's been a pleasure hearing you. I think it's one of the best, one of the most clearest interviews. This is the first time I've done a full-on interview, too. This is a first for me. But I've listened to lots of programs, lots of people speaking about it. But what you just told me, it's just holistic. I want to thank you for sharing this with everybody here. That's what we need to do more of, is to share all this information. And the vision is fantastic too. You brought up the vision of living simply and scaling down and community.
But you all have of to. It. And see, it's really funny because it's like, this is my life right now. I don't work, which has its own set of issues. But the thing is, I'm passionate about this. And if you're passionate about something and you believe in something, I think it comes over in what you have to say to other people.
Right,
okay?
Right.
And so I thank you for interviewing me, because hopefully when you go back to Australia, some of your mates will hear what I have to say and go, wow, this guy's right on target.
I think everybody needs to hear what you said. George W. Bush and all those people, you are in peril because you're going along this path as much as everybody else. We're all on the same boat. So we need to listen and clarify and find a way of just step back from the precipice. It's time to step back from the precipice.
No, and you're exactly right. You have to, because if you don't step back...
It's only one other way. It's just, that's it. Over the end. End story.
See, the problem is, if we travel down the nuclear road...
Yep.
Good, bad, or ugly, there's no turning around.
Yeah.
Because we will have been backed into a corner where the only way we can maintain even a reasonable facsimile of the life as we know it today is to continue down the nuclear road for at least 120 years.
And that brings up another issue, radioactive waste. The issue, the byproduct of it.
And I got to say something about radioactive waste.
Right.
Because it's a shell game. It's three-card Monty. And I don't know if you know what that
no,
is.
No, I don't know.
If you go, like, into New York City, you'll see, like, somebody scamming the tourist out of their dollars. They have two black cards and a red card, and they let you pick the red card, and you do it two or three or four times successfully, and then they get you to start taking money out of your pocket and making bets, and they all of a sudden get real good and much faster at hiding the red card, and you always lose. And that, in effect, is what they're doing with radioactive waste streams. And so, again, I have to back up and move forward. One thing that people need to understand, there is no military nuclear machine and no separate commercial nuclear situation. They're all one and the same twin Siamese Rosemary's baby. They're right. Literally evil Siamese twins, yeah. One inseparable from the other. And I won't go into that whole discussion other than one little facet of it. And let's talk about depleted uranium for a minute. One of the byproducts of creating nuclear fuel through the gaseous diffusion process, which is how we've created the majority of the fuel rods for nuclear reactors in its first 50 years of the nuclear industry, is through gaseous diffusion. A byproduct of that is depleted uranium. And, for instance, when I used to live in Ohio, you drive down to the Portsmouth gaseous diffusion plant, and we're talking tens of thousands of barrels of depleted uranium. And it's a very, very serious environmental problem. It's a very, very serious, again, radioactive nuclear industry waste problem. What are we going to do with all this?
And where are we going to bury it?
Where are we going to bury it?
Where do we bury it?
Well, therein, wise men concerned with corporate profits all got together and went to their scientists that are thinking inside the box and said, find something we can do with this depleted uranium, because we need to know what we can do with this. It's got to have some value. So therein is part of the problem, is when you give someone a targeted task like that, they only look at the targeted task. So these, like, wise men all got together and they started playing around with this depleted uranium, and realized that they could put it on the tips of ammunition and have armor-piercing bullets, armor-piercing rounds and rockets and everything. And it's like they went back and said, wow, you're not going to believe this. We found out that if you put the depleted uranium on the tips of a bullet, it can go through steel. Well, obviously, the Defense Department loved this. But so did the nuclear industry. And here's why. The depleted uranium now had a purpose.
Right.
It enhanced and made a product, even if it was a destructive product, better. That then meant that the depleted uranium was no longer a waste stream. They waved a magic wand and reclassified it as a potential future use resource.
Right.
And as a potential future use resource, it had value. And because it had value, it could then sit there forever.
Right.
That's now what they're trying to do with all the spent fuel sitting in all these reactors around the world.
Mm-hmm.
Let's look at GNEP. Global Nuclear Energy Program. The primary purpose of GNEP is, here's the way the gig works. You're foreign country A, it doesn't matter, pick a country, any country, and you want nuclear energy. Because without adequate energy sources, you can't join the industrial age. You can't, like, stop being a third world country. So America is going to go to you and say, well, here's what we're going to do. If you will sign this contract, we will give you the technology to build nuclear reactors, and we will supply you with all the fuel you need, and then we're going to take your waste streams at some particular point in time, and we're going to bring them back to America or to Australia or to England, because those are where they're seeing the primary reprocessing facilities being built.
Right.
Okay.
The Alliance.
All right. And we're going to take that spent fuel and we're going to reprocess it into MOX fuel. Oh, ding, 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 ding. Get the pin out, get the magic wand out, and you take all those waste streams and you wave that same magic wand over it. It's now a potential future use resource.
Right.
It's no longer a waste. And because it's no longer a waste, it, by law, can now sit on the reactor sites forever, waiting for its turn to go through the process. GE and Mitsubishi, all these companies that are going to build this whole new generation of nuclear reactors, basically like the AP1000, they're basically PWRs.
What's that?
They're the same reactors we have now, only bigger.
Oh, the bigger, the
okay,
bigger ones.
Words,
yeah,
but
the
they
bigger
work,
ones, yeah.
They work on the same concept. They still suck billions of gallons of water in, and they cool them, and they spit out, and they use the same kind of fuel.
Right.
Now, that's important to know, because the problem is, all this fuel that's supposedly supposed to go through this new GNEP reprocessing creates MOX fuel. So think about it. We've got the nuclear industry wants us to build a whole new fleet of 2,200 nuclear reactors around the world that won't be able to use the new fuel being created through GNEP. So it's a ruse. In other words, it's like once you start walking down that road, there's no going back because, for starters, for the first 100 years, because once they build that new fleet of reactors, they will last 100 years. And in the meantime, they're going to perfect the technology to make viable MOX fuel to supply this third generation of nuclear reactors that won't be built for 100 years. So in other words, this is what I'm saying. Is once we've gone down this road, there's no turning back.
Yeah, and in Australia at the moment, they've been scouting and they've picked certain sites to bury the waste, and they're on Aboriginal communities in the wilderness. People think Australia's got desert and where communities live. There are actually lots of life.
Abundance of life. And our gene pool, we've got there the seeds that would maintain life. That's where they want to bury it.
Yeah, I know, but let's be honest. Let's call a spade a spade.
Yeah.
What they're doing in Australia is the same thing they do here in America.
Yeah.
It's called environmental and economic racism.
Aha.
Okay.
Right.
In other words, let's call it what it is. Let's go find some poor community that can't afford to hire the attorneys and doesn't have the financial wherewithal to stop us from raping their community. And we're going to force a dump site. We're going to force a processing site. We're going to force a uranium mining facility. We're going to force a nuclear reactor. It's the same all over the world.
Right.
In other words, they take the kindest, gentlest, most loving people in the world,
right.
And because most of those people happen to live in rural communities, they have a simpler life, they get by on a lot less money, and it's like, pardon my French, we're going to fuck you. And yes, that's a vulgar word, but you know what? What they're doing to rural communities, what they want to do to the Aborigines, is ugly.
Well, they use the money. This is where we've got a big problem about the power of money. They use the power of money to let go of their former lifestyle, which is the crucial of life, of living on the earth.
And
change their lifestyle
and
to one that they're totally being. Aboriginal people have big problems because of what took place from the first when the Brits landed to right now, still as business as usual, the same thing in a different way.
But what I would encourage the people of Australia to do,
yeah,
and there's different sites you can look at, but because I'm most familiar with it, at Portsmouth, Ohio,
right,
which is home of the gaseous diffusion plant,
right.
Okay, look at all the plant workers who have died. Look at the poverty that's in the community because once the plant closed its doors and couldn't operate anymore, there is no other industry. And no new industry wants to come there because of the contamination. They sell you a dream, but it's a false dream. It's a fake dream. It's a nightmare waiting to be uncovered, okay? Right. Because, yeah, things might be great for 10 years or 20 years or 30 years, but when you get out to 50 years or 75 years and they've raped you and used you and now it's time to discard you,
yeah,
it destroys the community.
Right. Well, anyway,
I know, I'm such a cheerful person at 9:30 in the morning.
Well, I'm aware of it. You know, a lot of what you've told me is gut feeling brought me here to actually end up meeting you. I'm moving into an area of unknown, and I'm moving from a pseudo-sheltered area coming out here, which I had no idea. Meeting you has been deja vu. We'll call it off on that, Sherwood. And this is Benny Zabel signing off. And till next time. Bye.